Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Q Commentator episode 6. How did we get here? Yes, with me, Nick Heath. How are you? I hope you're in rude health as you listen along. Our sixth conversation on commentary. I bet you didn't think it would still be interesting. Some of you might never thought it was interesting at all. But I think it's proved that although it's one particular broadcasting job, the stories and insights from those we've heard of have brought different themes to the fore each time. And that's given each one its own flavour, I think. Michael Weeduck was one of those who got in touch after Bob Ballard's episode 5 chat, saying via Twitter to @QCommentator, it's a great series and listened to it last night. Liked hearing about how the commentator and co-commentator dynamic works in terms of Bob's work on the Diving with Leon. Lovely also to have support from the BBC LGBT Sport podcast, hosted by Jack Murley. Jack, we will meet for a beer or similar soon, I hope. Also thanks to Mark Gray for getting in touch as well. He thought Bob's critique of some commentators on Match of the Day sounding similar was perhaps due to the nature of the short 5-minute edits rather than allowing fuller coverage that could allow a bit more variation, which I think is a fair point. Probably some truth on both sides of that one, I would say. But plenty of you getting in touch, also having listened to previous episodes as well. You are not an unwieldy, throbbing, burgeoning audience in terms of numbers, but there's several hundred of you that are tuning in with regularity and making me feel so happy that you're getting something out of these conversations and are coming back for more. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. It's super to have you with me and hopefully to be bringing you more soon, given this is the last episode of Series 1, I hear you all say, but I have saved a good one for you. So, as ever, you can email qcommentator@rugbymedia.co.uk. You can tweet @qcommentator or contact me on @NickHeathSport, etc., etc. Do leave a rating or, even better, a review. I'll be your best friend if you do that. Also, some pretty exciting news. I'm thrilled to have been asked to be part of Podcast Live, a rugby special that's taking place at Twickenham on Saturday, the 7th of September. Check the diaries now while you're listening. It should be a fantastic event, featuring the likes of the Egg Chasers, Brian Moore, Will Greenwood, The Times and the Ruck podcast, and little old me. But I'm basically planning on having a super guest for a live Q commentator. I'm also hoping to be popping up elsewhere over the course of the day. So it would be amazing to see you there. You can book tickets now on podcastlive.com, just £42. And if you click to say you're coming mainly to see me, then I get a little kickback and I'll promise to give out free sweets at my one. There we go. There's a promise that will be kept. Free sweets if you book and say you're coming to see me. It would be great to have you there anyway. It's podcastlive.com for you to get those tickets. Saturday the 7th of September at Twickenham in their lovely new East Stand. Come and join Q Commentator and have the chance to see the rest of the guys who are taking part too. So, episode 6 of Q Commentator, the man who has been the voice of ITV football commentary for a decent number of years now, a man whose commentary I had as a ringtone in 2005, but more on that in a moment. It is, of course, Clive Tyldesley, and well, so far he seems to be a man who was focused and destined to do the job he now does, as you'll hear in the start of our chat in a moment, perhaps compared to more of those other people that have sort of come to it via other means. He spent his time on Match of the Day on the BBC. He's called countless finals in huge club and international football competitions. And in our conversation, we cover the natural textures of the human voice, perhaps where you have the sound of someone's lovely voice versus the content perhaps that they're capable of putting in it. the slow onset of talking in metric rather than imperial. And Clive really talks about a real focus on the importance of knowing your audience, which isn't something we've heard too much about previously. And I think it's really relevant where Clive comes from. His mentor in Reg Gutteridge, who we know Bob Ballard name checked last week, also talking about remaining current and remaining relevant. We also hear about the songs that Clive played on his late night rock show. Yes, that was a thing. Modern scrutiny, of course, with modern social media and the pressures that come with that. And then also quite a big conversation across the sort of sporting landscape in general about audiences perhaps not being big enough behind the modern paywall culture, the BT Sports and the Skies of the world, and how that is affecting the grassroots of sport and some of our biggest key sports across England and the world. Personally, I think it's an argument that really needs listening to, and Clive puts it across very, very well. And then perhaps what I can only call as the fanboying. At time of publishing, Liverpool have just won their sixth Champions League title. In 2005, when I was probably in one of my more passionate periods of being a Liverpool fan, I was watching all the games at the local pub, watched the final in Istanbul, of course, memorable because Liverpool were 3-0 down at half-time. Clive Tilsley's commentary when Steven Gerrard heads the goal in goes, "Hello, hello, here we go." And I had that as a ringtone because I couldn't believe how prophetic that commentary ends up sounding given what then happened in the game, Liverpool scoring another two, going to extra time and winning the game on penalties. And yeah, it's just, it's a magical piece of commentary for me. So I knew that at some point I was going to have to kind of do that moment of going, "We're just talking generally about commentary, but tell me everything about that moment and what you felt, what you did and everything." So Clive humours me, I think is the best way to put it, but does give us a few little gems of that process. So without further ado, and there's been too many minutes of ado, but thanks for listening. And here, Cue commentator, Clive Tilsley. Well, Clive Tilsley, thanks very much for your time. I believe you were mapping out destiny as a football commentator from a young age. Why was that? What were you listening to? What was the appeal?
I couldn't play football to any level. I couldn't play anything to any level, really. I was just fascinated, for some reason, by television sport. I suppose that most of the sport we witness is via a screen of some kind. It was a television. It's often mm-hmm. not now. I was brought up in the Manchester area. My dad took me to Old Trafford from quite an early age. And even on the walk back to the car, I would be compiling my 60-second report for Sports Report. And we'd get back to the car just in time for the classified reading of the results at 5 o'clock. And then there was a guy called Bill Bothwell, who was very often the reporter at Old Trafford, who gave his two pennyworth over 60 seconds. And I would be mentally comparing his observations on the match with mine. And this is,
were you better than
an alarming age.
Were you better than him on occasion?
Certainly not. I'm still not. It was just a passion. And I knew from an early age it was what I wanted to do. I recall going to see United play at Queen's Park Rangers. I must have been about 15. And I actually stood outside the BBC television centre for an hour or so and just watched people going in and out and just wanted to be one of those people. Mm. I just really, really wanted to work in that field, and I knew it.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. I have very similar memories of seeing things in production, or even if I saw a film set, or you know, the film light vans that you'd see down the street. And I'd always, it wasn't about wanting to see anyone famous. It was actually about, I want to be part of that. I want to know how that's put together.
And I was in my final year at university, and there was a commercial radio station opening in the city in Nottingham. And how did I get my first job? I just went and made a nuisance of myself. Really, it was classic knock on the door. To the point where about 2 weeks before I took my finals, I got a phone call from the program controller who made out at first that he was going to rebuke me for continually turning up at this building site, really, where they were constructing the studios, and then said, "I've decided the only thing I can do to get rid of you is to give you a job." And my first question was, what what degree do I need? And his answer was, you don't need a degree to make tea.
Yeah, good, excellent. Yeah, because you started there and at Radio Trent, Radio City in Liverpool. Was anybody at that stage telling you if you were any good?
Me?
Right,
I think... I think if I'm honest, what's the point of doing the interview if you're not? I am my own biggest critic. I still, to this day, try to watch back everything that I do, and usually alone, well, always alone, so that I can listen to it and review it critically, mm-hmm. and try to learn and improve. But I suppose we've all got memories of, you know, some kind of home movie that you've parents shot, and hearing your voice for the first time and thinking, that's not my voice. Oh, that sounds awful. And I had those, you know, I went through that phase, but I kind of got over that phase, and to the point where this sounds incredibly vain, but I think you do need an element of vanity, self-confidence and so on to progress in this business. And I think I probably had that from the start, and I certainly didn't mind the sound of my own voice from the time I started working.
Yeah, and it's come up in a couple of the other conversations I've had. So for those people who are listening to a series of these conversations, I hope it's not too repetitive. But there's an element of understanding and knowledge of one's own voice, if you're going to be broadcasting in it, that is absolutely set apart from those people that go, oh, I heard myself on camera, I don't like the sound of that. You might hear it and think, or certainly I would, and just go, or not be offended by it. And then certainly to be able to be in touch with your own musicality of your voice, and I think I think a musical ear is required. That's come up a few times.
Yeah, I think texture of voice is if there is a rich texture in a broadcaster's voice, I think it gives them a huge advantage, a huge natural advantage. It's like being, I don't know, tall in a rugby team, or strong or fast in a rugby team. It gives you an edge. And I would never ever review another commentator's work publicly, but I think there are certain commentators who've actually got by more on the quality of their voice tone than they have on the content of their work.
Yeah.
I don't think my voice was ever so strong that I could do that. So did
it take you time to find your voice?
I was 21 years of age when I first broadcast on Radio Trent. I've drunk an awful lot of red wine since then. So obviously my voice has changed.
But were you wary of it at the time? Did you have a sort of, you know, you said Manchester, did you have any form of accent or anything?
No, I think I have, I'm more sort of a traditional Lancashire background, the old Lancashire, North Manchester. I'm from Bury. After a bottle of red wine, I probably would say Bury rather than Bury.
Yeah.
I suppose the honesty in my voice comes out, but at the time when everybody's honesty, when you're angry and maybe from time to time the odd vowel will still slip, but I don't think that's a bad thing. I think in actual fact there's a greater acceptance now and almost an affection for a lot of regional accents in broadcasting, whereas probably when I first started to work in radio, the BBC English was still almost a requirement.
Mm.
And
now they want anything but.
Well, it would appear so, yeah. Yeah, I am quite... I mean, I think when you get to my stage of my career, you owe it to yourself and to your public to continue to review whether you are becoming a grumpy old man and whether you're remaining sufficiently contemporary. Fortunately, we've got four kids in their 20s, so that, you know, that gives you a touchstone immediately, which enables you to connect with a different generation. But
where are you on that scale at the minute?
Well, I think, strangely enough, I think you kind of grow back towards your children at that sort of age. And as a commentator who is in his 60s, I'm very aware of how I may be perceived, both by audience and potential employers. I don't think there's another television television football commentator at the moment who is talking in terms of meters as well as yards. Now, that is a conscious effort on my part. I don't think in terms of meters, but I have worked out that probably around about half the audience now do.
Mm.
And so, again, in order to serve them, it's like getting a close-up of Sir Bobby Charlton at a Manchester United game. It's not sufficient to say it's Sir Bobby Charlton,
yeah,
because there is vast numbers of people that you're broadcasting to who maybe kind of know the name, but don't really know who he is or why he's important and significant. So again, never assume knowledge. And I think by not assuming knowledge, you actually can remain current, and you can remain what I think is the most important element of good broadcasting, remain inclusive rather than exclusive. My mentor in the early years of my television career was the late Reg Guttridge, who was the ITV boxing commentator and just a wonderful man. And he took a particular interest in me, and he schooled me in a lot of the detail of commentary, but he also schooled me in thinking about what the job actually entailed. And he used to rebuke me for commentating to the dressing room, trying to impress football coaches watching, maybe football players.
Oh, really?
And he used to say to me, you know, is your grandma watching? It was one famous interrogation I got from him. And I said, yeah, she always watches my, whatever she was, 80-year-old grandma.
Yeah.
Said, well, she counts one viewer just like the England manager. Commentate to her.
Yeah.
Commentate to the taxi driver. Commentate to white.
Were you consciously aware that you were doing that?
I think when you get inside track and actually get to know footballers and get to have audiences with famous football managers and people,
yeah,
and you can actually stroll up and down dressing room corridors and people know who you are, there is a great danger that you become one of them.
Yeah.
If you're employed by the football industry, which I'm not really. I earn a living from football, but I'm employed as a broadcaster, as a communicator.
Yeah.
But if I was actually employed as a football coach, as a liaison officer, as a press officer, whatever, then that would be my core industry, and they would be the people that I considered my colleagues. And so you have a certain viewpoint on the game and the whole culture of the game, which is inside track. Broadcasters cannot be inside track. I would go so far as to say that occasionally organizations like Sky Sports, for all the good things they do tend to broadcast to the dressing room. And if you're not careful, you then, I think it's almost a different audience when you move onto a terrestrial channel where you're not talking to 1.5 million people who've subscribed to watch football and are therefore indoctrinated. You're now commentating to your Uncle Ernie and your Auntie Anne, who may only watch 5 football matches a year. I actually had a debate on the eve of the World Cup semi-final, which is the largest audience that I've ever worked with, as to whether actually that there's an argument for explaining the offside law at some stage during the commentary.
Right.
Because we've all been that kid sat in the back row of the maths class where you get 20 minutes in and you think to yourself, I haven't understood a word of this. You know? And it's just flying over your head. That's bad broadcasting.
Yeah.
And so in order to remain current, in order to remain relevant, I say you've almost got to take a step back from the microphone and ask yourself, what are you doing and who you're broadcasting to? And if the audience is 5, 8, 10, 12, 28 million, then the role of the community, the nature of the communication changes.
Yeah, the yards and meters thing is an interesting thing that you mentioned, because I had a commentary review session with Rob Nothman at the BBC, and it was fantastic and very valuable. But one of the things he said is, you're referring, he said, what is that marking on the pitch? And it's the 22 meter. Yeah. Cause even I, through my own, you know,
it's the 25 yard line to parentage mark your audience.
Yeah. It's 22 yards or whatever. So
it's a 5 yard scrum, you know, it is. And it's difficult. But without sort of trying to blow my own trumpet, in a strange sort of world, even though I'm in my 60s, I can remember what it was like being a young parent. But parenting in 30s and into the 40s, when kids are toddlers and then going to nursery school and then to secondary school, that becomes your entire world. You kind of almost lose sight of everything else that's going on in the world. So that, in actual fact, a 35-year-old commentator who's going through that may actually be living in a far more closeted world than I am.
Yeah, yeah, unless you're making a conscious effort. Now, TV came to you in the late 80s, Granada with rugby league, cricket and football. I'll maybe come onto those other sports in a second. the shift from radio to TV commentary, how do you think those first few went?
Well, it's one of the questions that you're asked most frequently. What's the biggest difference between radio and television commentary? And I actually pose it as a rhetorical question if I'm speaking to broadcast students. And the answer is you talk less, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, no, the answer is very simple. You're less important on television. Mm. It's a visual medium. And it's really, really important as a television commentator that you get your thick ego around that as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Because they can turn you down. They can't turn you down in radio, not if they want to experience the communication that you're trying to purvey. So that is far and away the biggest difference between radio and television broadcasting. And I think that radio broadcasting in many ways is more fun. I think you broadcast more from the heart as a radio broadcaster. You kind of plug in, the red light comes on, and away you go.
Mm.
And you obviously are partly descriptive. In television, you have to accept that secondary role. The man or woman who's in your ear, the director of the pictures, is far more important to the broadcast than you are.
Mm.
And so you follow their pictures. You listen to them. They're not listening to you. You're listening to them directing the cameras. So you've got maybe one or two clues as to where they're going next, what a replay is about to show. But that is the redefinition of roles as soon as you go into that visual medium.
And how did you find it?
I think it requires more discipline. I think you have to learn it. I mean, I've talked about Reg as my mentor. I had other people who helped me with the technicalities, almost the vocabulary of television broadcasting, to whom I'll be eternally grateful. I don't think I ever really needed anybody like that in radio. I remember my first program, Control. I actually had a late night rock show when I first started.
Lovely.
And which was lovely until I played all the music I liked, and I realized that
you have to play stuff
not that
you
actually
might not
the brief.
Yeah.
And
what were you playing, by the way? We should cover.
Gosh, nothing that anybody will have heard of anymore.
Come on, someone might.
Well, in those early years, I actually went to a couple of festivals. I went to Nebworth a couple of times and interviewed one of my all-time heroes, Frank Zappa.
Oh wow!
I interviewed Captain Beefheart. They were sycophantic, awful interviews. You know, they were basically just drool coming down my chin, and most of my questions were, "I think you're great."
Yeah. How'd you play the guitar so well?
Yeah, exactly. So not very objective interviews, but I was doing a late night show. I was on from 10 p.m. till 2 a.m. And the cleaners would inevitably come in at some stage, and during one show, I referred to a cleaner coming in and emptying the bins. And my program controller had me in the next morning. He said, don't. He said that there is a magic about radio. Don't talk about anything in the studio. Don't talk about the decks or the...
Yeah, don't tell them you're in a room.
Because you know, people listening, particularly at that time of night, there's an old movie called Play Misty for Me, which is... You know, all about the kind of romance of listening to how you can fall in love with somebody you've never met, who is just a voice, just a broadcaster, who becomes a friend, you know, becomes a solace to you in some sort of way.
Well, we know that.
You break that spell by talking about real things, you've got no chance of building that relationship.
Yeah.
So there are certain things that you need to learn about radio, specific things, but I think there are more things in TV because it's more technical. Because you are playing a supporting role.
Yeah, okay. You did rugby league and cricket, as I mentioned. You also went on to do basketball with the BBC. How do you enjoy those sports?
Well, I was a football commentator. That's what I wanted to be. Mm. And as much as I knew a sport, that was the sport that I knew. The basketball was an interesting example because I had 4 years at the BBC, which were really, really important. It was the organisation I always wanted to work for. So it's great to have done commentaries for Match of the Day and so on and worked alongside John Watson and Barry Davis. But when the Olympic Games came around every 4 years, you kind of, if you were new to the organization, they came to you about a year before and said, look, we want you to go to Atlanta.
Yeah.
We don't want you to do football. Football certainly was barely registered on the map as an Olympic sport in the 90s.
Yeah.
It's different now, but it certainly back then, I would be wasted as a football commentator in their eyes. And obviously it was the second Olympics of the dream teams, yep. men and women, but particularly the NBA stars who had been admitted in 92, and to commentate on them in Atlanta. Just seemed like a great gig to me. So, yeah. But I knew nothing about basketball.
I was going
to
say. So
I had at least I'd grown up in a bit of a rugby league background in the Northwest. So when I took up the rugby league for ITV, I had some kind of inkling. But in both cases, I had to learn the sports.
And how much do you have to learn the cadences of the delivery and the what are the moments to look out for?
Well, it was interesting, really, with the basketball because that was so short term. I think with rugby league, I was very lucky. In so much that Eddie Waring, who, it's easy to ridicule Eddie Waring, but he was one of those broadcast legends of the 60s and 70s, the voice of the sport. You don't get the voice of a sport anymore because there are so many commentators commentating on nearly every sport. But Eddie was, and Ray French, who took over, was another northern voice, a guy who'd played at a very high level, both rugby league and rugby union. I came in as a more neutral voice, as more of a journalist, broadcast journalist, with a more, probably a kind of more modern sounding approach to the sport. And the sport embraced it. They loved it. The sport, too, a lot of people in the sport felt that Eddie and Ray had kind of run down the image and reputation of rugby league. By being so northern, and so that was an open door for me, which I breezed through. Basketball,
just by being slightly less northern.
Well, yeah, and being actually commentating it in the same way that I would football. And I mean, just as an example of how wide the door was open, Widnes were probably the most successful team at that time. Jonathan Davis had left Rugby Union to go and play for them. Their coach was a guy called Dougie Lawton, who was a very, very good player and hugely successful as a rugby league coach. Very down-to-earth northern man. And I asked him once if I could come to a game and maybe spend some time around him, you know, before and after. And he just said, come and sit next to me during the match. And I sat, and we're talking about sitting next to, you know, whoever, yeah. Jose Mourinho or Jurgen Klopp during the match,
yeah,
you know, where the assistant sits, that's where I was sitting. And, you know, that's how much, to the degree to which Rugby League was prepared to help you in order to promote their sport.
Their
cursory
game.
Lesson for other sports. With basketball, I kind of learned the sport by going to watch basketball locally, by getting to know people in the British basketball scene. By obviously learning the laws. I even had videos which they sent out to basketball officials to help them referee the game. Until I actually started to call the game, I didn't really know how I was going to sound.
Yeah.
And the BBC brought in an American basketball writer who became my great ally, my sidekick for every match.
They're worth their weight in gold, aren't they?
And he loved the vocabulary because it was new and some of it wasn't actually ingrained in sort of
culture.
In basketball culture. But he felt that gave it something a little bit. So I guess in each case, I was adapting my football commentary to a new sport.
Yeah, excellent. And then after those 4 years, you were back with ITV. I know you've mentioned previously Brian Moore being one of those other voices that influenced you, also Reg Guttridge. You then became the main voice at ITV, countless Euros, World Cups, Champions League finals.
Let me tell you something about Brian Moore, who sadly died very too soon after he retired. And it wasn't really until I sat in the church at his funeral that I realised what a great man he'd been.
I count him as one of my influences.
Yeah, but big socialist, big Christian, a comprehensively educated child who got some kind of scholarship to go to a kind of a private or a grammar school, I can't remember, and felt a little bit left out, a little uncomfortable and had to kind of fight his corner. So, you know, where did his gift for the gab come from? I went to a boarding school where, you know, back in the time that I was educated in the late 60s, you either had to be tough or you had to be able to talk your way out of a corner. I wasn't tough. So there was a certain echoes of, if you like,
yeah,
of both of our childhoods, that we hadn't had it hard in terms of we hadn't had it economically or financially hard.
No, but it's all relative to your life,
yeah,
isn't it?
But we'd had to fight our corner by talking our way out. Now, I would bitch privately about Mauro, something terrible to myself, in the couple of years before he retired, and I was trying to make my way and trying to get more of the games.
Yeah.
He retired after the 98 World Cup final, and I remember pitching to my boss big time. I'd had a pretty good tournament, I thought, the games I'd been given.
Mm.
And I couldn't see why I couldn't have one of the ITV quarterfinals. You know, Brian was doing them both. And it was only kind of later that I came to appreciate what he had that I still haven't got. And I've talked about inclusivity as being a really important quality in good broadcasting. Warmth.
Warmth is
such... And it's almost difficult, almost impossible to define. You hear it in a voice like Dermot O'Leary. You hear it in Declan, particularly Declan, more so than Ant. It's just an engagement. Just the way they look into the camera, the way they talk to you, you feel as if... You know, you feel as if you could have a pint with these guys. You know, you feel as if you'd be... And by the way, you'd be right. They are both the kind of guys who you would strike up an immediate friendship. Once they trusted you, that you'd strike up an immediate friendship with.
But
and
you don't count yourself.
Brian Moore had in spades. Mm. Now, I was at that time very kind of smart ass, very clever with words, very sharp in idents, very well connected in terms of, you know, I knew kind of the tactics. I had an idea what formation any manager was going to. So yeah. I had a lot of things that maybe weren't as critical to Brian, but just that natural likability, such an amiable man, and somehow he translated that, you know, through the microphone, through the screen, and into the homes of the people who are, after all, are inviting you into their homes to accompany a very important event in their life, a football match.
Mm.
And I didn't identify it almost until it was too late, really, what Mauro had that I definitely didn't have then and certainly don't have to the degree that he had now.
Yeah.
Great war. Bill McLaren, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
If you look at if you wanted to be really ultra critical about Bill McLaren, certainly as a 21st century rugby commentator, you could be. In the same way that you could be, but Brian Johnston, wonderful, wonderful cricket commentator. But you could pick fault compared to the modern day, whoever you want to say, Vaughan or Atherton or whatever. But what those true great commentators had was that connection with this massive audience they were talking to. And it came because they were good people and they were able to make you believe that through the screen. Warmth is a big, big thing.
Mm. You've said that you don't feel you have it in the way that he did. How would you describe your voice that's so familiar to so many?
I think we're in a different era. And I think knowing Mauro as intimately as I did, you know, he was very, very helpful to me, despite my private bitchiness about, you know, whether I could identify a goal scorer half a second quicker than he, which actually doesn't matter a jot, yeah, as long as you don't get it wrong.
Yeah.
I think Twitter has changed a lot. I think if you talk to any modern broadcaster, they feel under constant scrutiny. And I must be clear about this. I'm not some kind of PC hater. I think most political correctness is absolutely correct. I think most political correctness is actually just consideration for fellow human beings and for feelings and trying to be respectful of anybody you come into contact with. And as a broadcaster, you come into contact with millions of people that you never meet. So it's very important to try harder to understand their circumstances and the positions and how they may be perceiving what you're saying so that you are respectful. So I've got no problem with PC as such. The problem with Twitter is just the kind of routine abuse levels, and the way that certain media organizations report it almost as if it was fact, and certainly as if it's some kind of opinion poll. Twitter is not an opinion poll. This is not a cross-section of people. These are just the loudest voices being heard. And I've got no problem at all. I'm not active on Twitter, but I have a Twitter account. And it's very important that I'm aware of the feedback in my app mentions during the course of a live broadcast night, in case I've said something which has somehow struck a nerve with an awful lot of people and needs addressing. That is important. I don't mind, although I don't make a point of looking through my app mentions after a game, seeing a load of your useless, with lots of expletives added. That's fine. That's a matter of opinion. What is difficult are what I call the Twitter vultures. Did he just say, what's that? Was he trying to say? And before you know it, the original debate as to whether he did say that and what he did mean has actually been overtaken by the discussion of what he might have said and what it might have meant. Mm. And on the day of the... and this is a rather sad indictment, and I don't want to give any kind of glass half empty. I've got the best job in the world. I love my work, and I look forward to every game that I do. And a World Cup semi-final involving England, Gareth Southgate, who was at our wedding, a really, really close friend.
Yeah.
It's as big and as good as my job can possibly get. Biggest audience I've ever worked with. Best feel-good probably among that audience that I've ever had the privilege of working with. But on the day of the game, somebody close to me professionally said, you don't seem very excited. And I heard myself say, and you can bleep this if you want, I can only fuck up tonight. There is nothing I can do tonight to enhance my reputation in any way at all.
Yeah.
All I can do, and that was the exact word I used, is mess up.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that Morrow and Murray Walker and Bill McLaren and Henry Longhurst, and certainly Peter Alice, who's had some issues, all those great names, even Barry and Motti to a degree, I think they'd have found that level of scrutiny difficult.
Yeah.
I think they'd have found it, I think they would have found that it would be a little inhibiting.
Mm.
And it's a shame that we've reached that position where... literally, I used to play a game when Top Gear was in its pomp as to how far into the program Clarkson would get before he said something that would end my career.
That if you'd said...
7 or 8 minutes.
That if you'd said...
Same box, same time of night, same corner of the living room, and yet he can be irreverent. I'm not an elected official. I'm not a priest, not a church leader, not a school leader. Where have I inherited this responsibility?
There are parameters within
so
which
many people
we expect people to act, aren't
that
they?
I can pervert or offend. Where's this come from? Why can whatever Mock the Week say a million things which I cannot say? I don't necessarily want to say them. As I say, I've no problem with PC. I think it's good. I think it's... I say it's respectful.
Is this coming from a
level of scrutiny which inhibits you?
Is this coming from a place of an episode or two that have hurt you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. One or two things that could have got out of hand. Nothing that I am ashamed of.
Yeah, yeah.
Or really uncomfortable with. I mean, if I give you an example, probably the most extreme example in recent years would be 2 years ago during the European finals. Now, I was working at Radio City in Liverpool at the time of Hillsborough. I was actually at the Heysel Stadium counting dead bodies. By a quirk of fate, I was not at Hillsborough. Everton played in an FA Cup semi-final the same day at Villa Park, and I broadcast that game. But I was very, very heavily involved in the aftermath of Hillsborough and feel involved in it to this day.
Yeah.
I know two people who died, and I, from that evening, when I was called in by my boss to host a phone in the following morning, I have a very strong personal passion about the fight for justice, which the families have undertaken and to a large extent now won.
Mm.
So it would be difficult outside of my own family and those I love to think of anybody I would less want to offend than the Hillsborough families.
Yeah.
During England's opening game at the Euros, they were much better than Russia. They took a long time to score the first goal, and eventually Eric Dyer scored. And this is a minute after the goal. Glenn Hall said something to the effect of, wow, they've really, really deserved that. I'm so pleased. And I came out with a very, very trite phrase, which was justice for the England 11. That's what I said. And moved on.
Yeah.
It wasn't my greatest commentary line by any means, but you know what it meant.
It's entirely inoffensive.
By the time
though.
I came off air, I was in the midst of a Twitter storm that I had offended the people who died at Hillsborough.
Good grief.
Justice. The word justice.
Just quite a leap.
Now, it's easy for you and I to sit here and debate that nobody's got a monopoly on the word justice. And by the way, there'd been justice for the Weatherfield 3 on Coronation Street. There have been any number of you know, uses of that kind of a phrase. And people have been even more trite than I'd been with it. But, you know, I was now contacting Andy Burnham. I was now contacting Margaret Aspinall and trying to, I suppose partly selfishly, but mainly out of sheer shock and horror that this was being levelled at me. And that's how quickly it can happen.
I mean, because in some of these things, the you know, particularly I would say with things like Twitter storms, and unless it is escalating without you being, you know, to a frightening degree, you know, almost recognising it and apologising for it is taking it to a place that it might not have got to anyway.
I didn't apologise immediately. I contacted I was fortunate in so much as I was writing a weekly blog for Kick It Out at the time. I'm sort of heavily involved with Kick It Out, which is which became a platform for me to put my case.
Mm.
And part of my case was, wow, I've got to be careful here. I've got to be more careful than I realise, because if the word justice can offend people, then any number of, and I did it from a slightly confessional point of view, but I made it absolutely clear that I refuted any suggestion that I'd been disrespectful. But I tried to be a little bit more intelligent than that and look at it and ask myself whether, you know, even a throwaway comment of that kind. I mean, we can both go and see a comedian, and he or she may tell a joke which I think's funny and you think's unfunny, that I find offensive and you find totally inoffensive. So the first thing is, again, nobody, least of all the Daily Mail, have got a monopoly on what's morally acceptable in this world and what's not.
Yeah.
So which is fine, you and I debating now coolly, you know, in this kind of setting, but obviously football matches are everybody's running a fever when they're watching them, and stuff, you know, pours out, which is, you know, people might find, even if they've just got an attachment to the club, they may find it, in inverted commas, offensive. So I tried to recognise that in my confessional at the same time as defending myself. But once I heard from Margaret that the families didn't find that offensive, then actually I could sleep comfortably.
Yeah, yeah. You
know, well, but I knew that I hadn't offended the people that really mattered.
Yeah. Well, there should have been no chance that you ever did with a remark like that. It's incredible.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm going to take you back because there's a slight that side of things is interesting, but I want to take you back to the question I asked, which was, how would you describe your voice that's familiar to so many?
I think I'm the worst. I think commentators are the worst judges of commentators anyway. But I'm one of the many, many fortunate things about my job is I can walk down Oxford Street and nobody's got a clue who I am.
Yeah.
Occasionally, I will walk into a shop and order something, and somebody will say, "You, Clive Tilsey."
I suppose
it is. It's the oral birthmark that I carry around with me. My answer is always, it depends whether you like him or not.
Yeah.
If you don't, I'm John Watson.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. In terms of prepping for football, I mean, I'll get a rugby team at midday on a Friday, and I'll do 3-4 hours prep on that. Football teams can be announced just before kickoff. I'm intrigued as to that world. Now, I know fellow football commentators that say, well, you prep on 70-80% of the expectation and that's it. In that regard, is that accurate in terms of your history and have you found that?
I think my attitude towards prep has changed over the years. I think it's important to do it. I think it's important, particularly for a live game where you are the principal broadcaster, to go on air knowing more about and around that game than anybody who's watching. I think that's kind of your job.
Mm-hmm.
That's not difficult to do if you've got time and resources. The difficult bit is how you use your prep.
Yeah.
I've never been trained as a journalist. I have written newspaper columns and newspaper reports on matches and so on. But I would hope that I'm reasonably editorially strong. I think that is one of the things that I was taught by my first boss in television, a guy called Paul Doherty at Granada Television. We would have a Friday evening preview program, and I would go out and do interviews Wednesday, Thursday, and then come back and edit a 3-minute piece. And he would ask me as I left the building with the film crew, "What's the story?" And he would ask me when I came back into the office, "Now what's the story?" And it's a bit of a kind of almost like a fable of a tale. And he would do it every time, when he comes.
Yeah.
But actually, he made the point to the extent that I remember it and pass that tale on over and over again.
Mm.
And actually, when you sit down and write your intro words for teams coming out and so on and so forth, and the team captions, then I am continually have the voice of Paul Doherty echoing in my head, "What's the story? What does this mean? Why is it of interest?" And you can have a welter of facts and figures. And I actually think that there are one or two commentators who should have a little trailer going across the bottom of the screen, which says, "I've flipping well done this research, so you're damn well going to hear it." You really should only be using 10% of the information that you've compiled in front of you. But the prep is important. I lay it out very neatly in 3 different colours in a certain style.
Handwritten?
That's my safety net. Yeah. That's how it goes into the head as you're writing it out. Alec Ferguson had the two Champions League commentary charts that they won, United, framed in his office. You know, they are actually almost like a piece of a fairly anal art, but a piece.
Well, they're a moment in time, aren't they?
Yeah. They represent the moment pretty well, like almost like a homegrown program, if you like, match program. But that's all safety net. I think if somebody stole it 30 seconds before it went on air, I think I would be worried. But I I could still do the broadcast. That's they're not absolutely essential. I don't know how often I really look down at them during the, but they're there. And I have a note on goal scoring for every player. But I only use that fact even when they score, or if they have a near miss and they haven't scored for 3 years or whatever. But I do hear biographical information being trotted out. And I actually think the information that's more important is not what their last club was or how much money they cost. It's the story of the day. I will probably Google news each player rather more than Google fact each player. I'd see what the story is about that player, who they're being linked with, whether they've got a contract up, you know, whether the manager has said something about them. I think that's a more interest and relevance.
It's than, personality than information,
figures.
Isn't it?
Yeah. What would appear really in on the you know, I struggled to even think about the back page. I can't remember when I last picked a newspaper up, but what was back page news?
What have been your favourite names to get your lips around over the years?
I never have a huge problem with that because, you know, but when I hear people sort of say, "Ah, oh, don't call him Aspilicueta, we call him Dave." Well, he's called Aspilicueta, you just learn it, you know?
You've never had a problem learning names?
No, I don't think so.
Because it's
no,
critical to the craft, I think, to get it right.
Yeah, I think we can get a little too anoraki about pronunciations. I always do try to get pronunciations right. I'm not having players changing their names halfway through their careers. you know, I'm sorry, Andrew Cole, but he's scored 300 goals as Andy Cole. I'm in the identification business. I can't suddenly start calling you Andrew Cole because your mum has now decided that she wants you to be Andrew. It's too late. You are a brand. You're Andy Cole. You're Andy Cole. He scores goals or whatever. You know, that's who you are.
Yeah.
And similarly with, you know, when new players come into our game or onto our radar, we do try to check the pronunciations, but I don't do... I don't do tha-tha-tha in Spain because if you try to use a sound which is not actually in the English language, all you're doing is making it. There was a really good story, Ruud Gullit, who worked with ITV on a World Cup a few years ago. Des Lynam was the host because this was the story. And Des sort of checked with him. It is Gullit, isn't it? And Ruud said, "No, call me Gullit." And again, you know, Des, who was absolutely magnificent to work with, said, "Well, it's a bit late now because you scored a goal in a European Championship final as Ruud Gullit." And what Ruud was saying was actually that it's a guttural sound that you don't make.
Yeah.
So you Gullit's wrong and Gullit's wrong, but what's right, don't worry about. Yeah. I don't mind either way. So may as well call me Gullit because it's a G and that's what you would call it.
Yeah.
So he was particularly unconcerned. So trying to be clever with, I mean, this, the guy who plays for Southampton, Pierre Højbjerg, it's Højbjerg. I mean, that's what he is, you know? And if he, you know, comes knocking at my front door and says, "Look, mate, you're getting it wrong. I need you to get it right. It's very important to my life," I might think about it. But as somebody whose name is constantly mispronounced... you get cold calls, don't you, from somebody who's trying to sell you. And it's just that lovely moment when you pick your own domestic phone up and somebody is breaking the law. They say, "Hello, is that Mr. Tyler's name?" "No, you got it wrong. Sorry." And you, that's fine. Yeah. So I've been there. It doesn't really worry me too much.
Yeah, okay. Champions League final 2005. Now, I don't know if anyone's spoken to you about the prophetic nature of your commentary that night. I've got a confession to make here. I know we said we wouldn't be too episodic about incidents, but there are particular moments you admire by certain broadcasters, and this is one of them where I've got a bit fanboy about it. So you'll have to entertain me momentarily. As we know, it was 3-0 at halftime, Maldini goal on 50 seconds, 2 by Crespo. I ended up having your piece of commentary on Gerrard's goal as a text alert for about 6 months because I just thought the prophetic and brilliant nature of it was so good, because you said, "Hello, hello, here we go. Steven Gerrard puts a grain of doubt in the back of Milan minds," which you may well remember. And there was something about the "hello, hello, here we go" when they're 3-0 down and it was just one goal back, that when I've watched the game back again, and I was watching highlights of it again this week, and it's so sort of passionately optimistic to the audience. It is as if you know how the night's going to end. And And I'm fascinated by where your head was at that point. Is that about telling people? You know, are you doing more of a broadcaster's job to keep the audience?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple of stories. I think that the 99 final was probably more prophetic. That, you know, whatever it was, can they score? They always score.
Yeah.
And that actually came from a piece of broadcasting I heard by Mark Lawrenson, strangely, on Five Live on the Saturday when the FA Cup final, it was on the Friday evening, actually, he'd been asked for a prediction about the FA Cup final. And he said, well, it won't be Manchester United nil. They always score. And it wasn't factually correct, but there was a feeling about that Manchester United team that you remember Giggs's goal in the semi-final.
Very Loro as well,
and
isn't
so
it?
On and so forth. That they always seem to find a way to win a game in Turin and so on. And so forth.
Yeah.
So I think that was more based on some kind of editorial stroke gut instinct that Manchester United aren't quite out of this. And they had just for the first time that night started to pose a bit of a threat in the 5 minutes prior to that. So that there was a certain amount of crescendo about that. I watched the 2005 final back in its entirety for the first time. I watched it probably the following day, but then I watched it again before the two teams met again 2 years later in the final.
Mm.
And I'd forgotten how little of the game Liverpool had outside of those 6.5 minutes when they scored the three goals.
Mm.
Once it got back to 3-3, Milan carried on dominating the game just as if they did never happen.
Yeah.
And Dudek made that crazy save and they went to penalties and so on and so forth. But Liverpool played far better in 2007 against Milan and were beaten. They had very little of that game. It was an extraordinary game for so many reasons. I can't think, and I'm not naming names, that Champions League winners' medals have been handed out to six less deserving cases than half a dozen of the players in that Liverpool team.
I would agree.
That match was won by about five or six players.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mainly by Steven Gerrard was three of them.
Yeah.
He played in three different
positions. Although
that.
You know, I'm happy to call out Jimmy Traore as one of those people you would be surprised to have a Champions League medal, but he makes that clearance on the line.
He makes the clearance, yeah. So, and Spencer actually played really well when he came on. Carragher had a great game, but there weren't many.
I'm going back to, you know, Smeets a goal. It's in. Two goals in 2 minutes for Liverpool. Yeah. Then you leave a brilliant pause, which is what a TV commentary is all about, because you allow the atmosphere to hold and then you come in with miracles are possible.
Yeah,
and it's like, oh my god, now it's 3-2.
Big difference between 2 and 1. I mean, the one came from nowhere.
True.
Funnily enough, it just came back into my thinking in the last few days. I did a game where Liverpool played in Paris against Paris Saint-Germain and were absolutely shocking. And I was doing it live for ITV. They, I think, went 2-0 down, but it was 2 going on 22, rather as it was 3 going on 33 in Istanbul that night. And I actually got I was starting to sound as if we had the second leg the following week, and I must have been starting to sound as if this is all over, because Liverpool are terrible and they're getting well beaten here. And I got a voice in my ear from a guy called Jeff Farmer, who was my editor on the night, saying, build it up a bit. And I very rarely had that at any stage in my career. Come on, sell this.
Come on, yeah.
And about 2 minutes later, PSG scored for a third time. And I actually went on the lazy just to hear him. Just like, now what do I say?
You know? Yeah.
So I think there was a bit of an element of you never know.
Yeah,
when they got one back, because there was no sign of a comeback. Whereas there was a sign of a United comeback, I think, towards the end in 99. There wasn't at that stage any sign of a Liverpool comeback.
Yeah.
So
and then mission accomplished.
Stevie mentioned it in his book, funny enough, which is nice.
Oh, did he? I didn't notice that.
Yeah, which was lovely. So I mean, people do remember it, and that's nice.
Yeah.
But I've no idea where it came from.
Yeah. Well, it's one of my.
I'm not sure it was justified.
It certainly was in terms of the atmosphere of the night. And then the question, you know, and plenty of people will obviously write details of the top and write some outlines here and there. Do you write lines? Because, you know, hearing things, particularly using that game as an example, purely because I was watching it, you've got the penalty save of Shevchenko that Dudek saves. And then there's the two phrases, the European Cup is returning to Anfield and to Liverpool. Liverpool are champions of Europe again. Now, it's feasible that a line like that is written on either side of your paper. Is that what you would do?
Yeah, for a cup final, and particularly for the, more particularly, funny enough, for the trophy presentation, which I think is a commentary You've almost peaked and done the game, and then you go back to the studio, and then go back for the trophy presentation, and I think you've almost got to kind of gather yourself. You've probably used all your best stuff by now, anyway.
Mm.
So when I know I'm doing a trophy presentation, I do two sides of a piece of paper with some pertinent facts. They're not lines as such, but are. It's really what's going back to what's the story that. Real Madrid have now won this four times in 6 years. No team since the 90s. So all those facts that are relevant to that, and similarly, all the facts that are relevant to them losing, I write out in terms of little kind of half phrases and headlines which I can use. And for the actual trophy lift, that moment which might get replayed, similarly for the final whistle, then what does this moment mean?
Yeah.
And I think you've just I can't remember those lines, but I'm glad that they're the lines because they're nothing too fancy. They are exactly. Just statements.
Yeah. Well, that's the fact of the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kings of Europe again. Top of the world. Yeah, yeah. Whatever. I mean, maybe a different way of saying the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's what needs to be said.
What I don't think is very good commentary is somebody saying, "Oh, it's fantastic. It's wonderful. It's just brilliant." Think it through. What does it mean?
Yeah.
What is the significance of this club winning this match or this trophy?
Yeah.
So I'll do a little bit of that, but they're not. I mean, the stuff like whatever name on the trophy and stuff that wasn't. You can't anticipate a game where Manchester United going for a treble play pretty poorly, Bayern Munich. Scuffed two chances in the 82nd and 86th minute, then substitute their captain, and then United bring on two substitutes and win the game. You can't.
Yeah.
I mean, how many different scenarios have you got to write before you get to page 56?
Yeah.
So no.
You're careful to ensure the right words are used. I read an interview with you where you've said, a goalkeeping error is not a disaster or a tragedy.
I think Heysel did that for me a little bit. I think and Hillsborough. I think living on Merseyside and working on Merseyside and working directly with the fallout from those two very different events, in my opinion. But they were both tragic because people died. People went to football matches and didn't come home. That's a tragedy.
Mm. There's a few
letting the ball slip through his hands is not. I think vocabulary is really, really important, and I do try to give thought to using the correct vocabulary for a particular. I try not to use great very often because I think that's quite a special word. Certainly in terms of a great player or a great manager, I try to be fairly selective when I use that word.
Some people don't like words associated with war, do they? Things like this is a battle. This is, those sorts of things.
Very often, the best football, the biggest football cliches are the best use of the vocabulary for that particular. A game of two halves is a game of two halves. If you have a match in which one team went 2-0 up at half time, the other team, right, then it is a game of two halves.
And yeah.
You can get parodied in private eye very quickly for doing. I remember once reading in Coleman Balls, John Watson, who I really know and really, really like, saying that the Argentine squad at the World Cup are numbered alphabetically. And that was in Coleman Balls as an error. No, they were numbered alphabetically. Ardiles was two.
Yeah.
You know, that's exactly how they numbered their squad.
Yeah.
It was a succinct and clear a definition of the way they numbered, and yet it was seen as something comedic. No, it wasn't comedic at all. He was right.
It's
you that's wrong. So I tend to use calamity a lot. I think calamity is more maybe it's an onomatopoeic thing. Calamity just sounds more like a clown dropping a bucket of water. Then catastrophe, disaster, and tragedy, I tend to steer clear of.
Yeah, okay. What moments are you most proud of? I can tell, so far in our conversation, you're going to be a man who shies away from this question.
Well, I think other people judge you.
Are there one or two moments that stick in the mind where you've thought, I've nailed that pretty well?
I think the most important football match in my career, because it was 12 months after Brian Moore's retirement, 12 months into my stint as ITV's senior commentator, which I guess I still am, was the 1999 Champions League final. There was an audience of 20 million. There was a very big finish. And if I'd got that wrong in some way, then I wasn't exactly on trial. I had a contract and I had employers who were confident in me. But if I'd messed up that night, as opposed to the kind of Twitter definition of messing up, they would have been entitled with the contracts they had, FA Cup and Champions League, to see if Motti fancied a bit of Champions League. So I think getting that right that night, those 5 minutes right, was really important in my career. And I think the best seconds of that 5 minutes of commentary were the silences after the two goals went in, the thinking time.
Mm.
And where did Name on the Trophy came from? It came from those... I mean, there are 3 seconds. I mean, it's not just a breath. There is, if you listen back to it, there is some clear thinking time. And again, something that Reg gave me. There was an incident, funny enough, the year before, when Michael Owen scored against Argentina, Mauro was commentating. I was in our kind of Paris HQ with Peter Drury and a lot of other people watching the game. And when Owen scored, we were all leaping around. There was total bedlam. And when we finally all sat down again, I actually said to Peter Drury, rather prophetically, that if we're ever fortunate enough to commentate on a moment like that, we've just learned you can say whatever you like for the next 10 seconds because nobody will hear it.
Yeah.
They'll hear it again one day.
Yeah. But don't say anything.
Yeah. But I think that, the silence is... I think the pacing of a commentary is very, very important. I think a lot of 2018 commentators talk far, far too much. I think they get nervous about filling the gaps.
Mm.
I don't know whether it's a modern style. There's a more conversational style of commentary now, which, again, I think isn't very inclusive. I think it all gets a bit chummy and...
I'm
going to say it, Fletch this and Macca that. No. Not for me.
Yeah.
Darren and Steve, fine, but not too many of those, please.
Yeah.
Just commentate. Have a relation. Doesn't matter who you are.
You are in good company with Mr. Barry Davis, who feels very similarly.
Yeah. I mean, then you can control the pace of the commentary far better than as the lead commentator. If you've got that understanding that it's not going to be as conversational as that.
Yeah.
I think in jokes and what you said at lunch. And I mean, what? I mean, goodness me.
Yeah.
Have you had a bet on that? I hate, again, going back to ageism, which I may well be suffering from a little bit now. And again, asking people to look beyond the actual age of somebody and the way that they commentate. You'd never ever hear me say, goalkeepers these days don't want to pick the, they just want to kick. I would never say these days.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like immediately dates you. Well, there are people half my age saying things like that.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to tackle these days. I mean, what on earth does that mean?
It gets someone's back up immediately, doesn't it?
Somebody of 15 or 16 years of age, no idea. I mean, that's what the only football... That they know, you've got to be inclusive. You've got to think, you've got to think about the size and the breadth of your audience and commentate to them accordingly. That is part of our responsibility. It's part of the art of communicating. So silences are very much a part of that.
Yeah,
and maybe the best commentary I've ever done was shutting up for a few seconds after each of those two very big goals in my career.
Yeah. Martin Tyler was someone I was looking up recently, and actually looking at the famed Aguero goal. And there's 9 seconds after he says Aguero to when he then says, "You'll never see anything like that again." And watching that and actually timing it and going, "There you go. There's a moment to let the crowd."
He says, "I swear you'll never see it." Something like that, isn't it?
I think so.
Which I think is great. That's right. Yeah. That's right. You don't prepare that.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Any that you consciously, to this day have brought with you in terms of I'd love to have done that again.
Oh, every game. No, every game when you watch it back.
Yeah, okay.
What are you
liable to? Is there anything you pick out?
I think I used to be far too smart ass. I think I still lapse into it occasionally. it's a fine line because in order to entertainment is part of what we do. Obviously, information, insight, et cetera, all those things that you're trying to do, identification and so on. They are, if you can, the important scaffolding of putting a commentary together. How do you embroider it? You embroider it maybe with a little turn of phrase, which hopefully I have from time to time, and maybe with a pithy remark, something which makes people laugh, or maybe something which is a bit naughty, but you know, within the confines that the 21st century will permit. And with those, they either work or they don't, and you kind of know halfway through saying them whether they're working or not.
Yeah,
and when they don't work, they are horrible.
Yeah. Beyond the spontaneous lines, you've also given plenty of rehearsed ones to video games over the years.
Yeah.
What's that like?
And
you've
hard work.
You've scripted some of it as well, because it needs to be natural, I guess.
When I inherited the FIFA contract from Motti, funnily enough, I had a son who is now 23. So I guess probably around about the age of 6 would he be playing. So it was a long time ago. And so I think I probably had more of an insight as to how important this was and could be in the lives of a lot of people, and therefore in my career.
Yeah.
And I think there was a period when I was the main voice on FIFA, where I probably was getting as much exposure from that as I was from being ITV's lead commentator on a lot of live football.
Yeah, arguably more, probably.
Yeah, yeah. But just in terms of profile, I think it probably meant as much to... So it was very important to me that we did the job properly. EA at the time... I mean, the game was always made in Vancouver. It was made by quite a lot of British guys, but a lot of Canadian guys too. The soundtrack was always perceived to be secondary to the gameplay, although in actual fact, at that time, Pro Evo probably was more popular with game players, because there was, I think, at that time, the gameplay on Pro Evo was better.
I went from FIFA to Pro Evo.
Yeah, but I think FIFA then rectified
that. It did,
that.
Yeah.
They always had the licenses, so you didn't have London United and all that,
indeed,
which was a
yeah.
big selling point. And then I think we improved the soundtrack too. And I think I was part of that. I actually went over to Vancouver twice and gave seminars to the guys making it about the importance of sound. When I inherited the script, it was full of kind of one-off lines, which were great the first time you heard them, but if you played FIFA for 6 hours, they drove you around the bend.
Yeah.
And I persuaded them that good commentary was not invasive. I've always had this thing about a little kind of illustration of good commentary, that if you go into an Italian restaurant and they're playing Italian music in the background, you don't listen to that music. It just becomes part of the ambience. It's probably very much a caricature of Italian music, but it kind of fits the setting. If you go in and you hear Indian sitar music, you notice it straight away.
Yeah.
And I think commentary is a little bit the same. If you are somehow not matching the pictures in some way, you're not complementing the pictures, if you're trying to override the pictures in some way, then I think you become invasive. And the commentary scripts on FIFA were invasive. They were, I think, cutting into people's entertainment, the enjoyment of the actual gameplay. So I tried to take a step back, really, and just make them more authentic.
Yeah.
How do you write them? Well, it's kind of like a family tree. You have a corner kick, and then you have good corner, bad corner. You have short corner, long corner, good and bad, and so on. So they grow these scenarios.
Yeah.
Which come in little bursts of about 4 seconds.
Yeah.
So you write a corner, and then on the script they'll have, it's a corner, and then there's 20 empty spaces for you to write another 20 versions of it's a corner. A corner, then corner given, so it's a long process writing the script and making sure that each line then marries, so that you don't have one of these kind of train announcements where the next train on platform is the and one or two of the old cricket commentaries, even Benno, you know, who is like one of the absolute doyens, would be a little bit where they hadn't recorded the whole score, so it was Australia are 135.9.
Yeah. Yeah.
So finding the proper match in the intonation was another thing that I introduced.
And you become an actor in the voiceover, don't you?
Because absolutely.
You've got to create the scenario.
So when you sit in the studio for 8 hours a day for 5 days, and part of that is final score here is Albion Rovers 2. You've got to, final score here is Stranraer 2. And then you do another session of Stranraer 1, Stranraer 3.
Yeah.
And so you are continually, and now they've got the intelligence to,
they know
to,
which
to
one it,
all them those yeah, together. Yeah. That's not the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is recording it in such a way that it makes it easy for them to link it together.
And that you don't lose your mind.
And that was the change that I guess I brought about to the English language version of FIFA, making the commentary less invasive, more naturel, and also taking more care to make sure that it all fitted together.
What would you like to have commentated on that you've never had the chance to?
As a sport or
sport event?
Well, I've got a passion for golf, but I think sports like golf and cricket almost require former professionals. I think the sort of classic team of in a football commentary is the broadcast journalist, the guy or woman who's had their career is as a broadcaster, so they've learnt. I mean, I've edited football matches. I've edited highlights of football matches. So once you've done all of those things, logged football matches, gone out, done filming, you are a broadcaster. So you have a feel for the medium, and then you have this guy or woman who is the co-commentator, and they are the messenger. They are the person that we always wanted to be. The person who's actually been down there on the field. Been there, seen it, done it, and then have to somehow learn a skill as to how you come back and tell the rest of us what it's like to analyse it and quickly during the course of a game. It's not enough just to a great player doesn't necessarily make a great co-commentator because you've got to become a broadcaster. You've got to learn a little bit about our broadcast our broadcast profession. So that in golf and cricket, I'm not sure you need that lead person. You need a presenter just to hold the whole thing together, but you maybe don't need that lead commentator because there's no play-by-play feel to it. I often say, when asked my favourite commentator, I talk about a guy called Pat Summerall, who was the straight man to John Madden when NFL first came to our screens, back in the days of John Riggins and Theismann and Marino, and they were the voices that I heard. And he was a very economical, succinct, understated builder of tension. A lot of the vocabulary of American football commentary are numbers, third down and five or whatever.
Yeah.
And what's on the clock, but he was able to use that and present it in such a way which wasn't overblown, but built tension, built drama, and I suppose if I could have been another commentator, Summerall would probably have been the guy.
Well, Clive, you're approaching your last week of commentating on sport. It's a 7-day period. You get to choose what you're going to commentate on. How would it all end in an ideal world?
I've never had a tick list. I think probably when I started in television commentary, commentating on an FA Cup final was almost perceived to be the ultimate, maybe because there was a bit of competition between John and Barry at the time as to who would do the cup final for the BBC. I was 4 years at the BBC, obviously got nowhere near the cup final, but I did commentate on FA Cup finals for ITV. And then, clearly I've been fortunate enough to commentate on Champions League finals and World Cup finals. I haven't commentated on a World Cup final with England in it, but I guess a semi-final exclusively live on ITV is almost as big, if not bigger, certainly in audience terms it would be. So, yeah, they're kind of all done. I would love to be commentating on major live football on terrestrial television to large audiences on a more regular basis. If you really wanted to waste an hour of your life, you'd just need to ask me about the changing face of televised football and the danger of football taking its core audience for granted. I think that the current subscription model for exclusive television rights in the UK is in danger. We've operated to this model now since Sky came onto the scene in 1992. People, including ITV Digital, have fallen by the wayside trying to do it. Tell me, £10 million for a Premier League game is too much. You cannot monetize that. Why are Amazon and Google not getting involved? Because they can't get their money back on that.
Yeah.
Sky and BT have become involved in a bit of a...
an inflation war.
Yeah, which I think is hurting both of them too. Audiences aren't big enough. I think there is unease within UEFA about the audiences for Champions League now. And it's not BT's fault. It's just the nature of the beast. That you know, 1 million, 1.3 million, 1.5 million, 2 million for a big game is how many people watch a game on subscription television. We saw the audiences on BBC, and this is not an ITV advert, because the audiences were the same on BBC during the World Cup for fairly run-of-the-mill games because it was free and live. It's our national sport. From coming home from the World Cup finals, nobody from that England squad was going to appear in a live game on terrestrial television again until January, until the FA Cup. That's not right. When I say it's not right, it's not healthy for the future of television. As I've said already, we've got four kids in their 20s. I'm not saying they don't like football. The three boys do like their football very much. But they consume it in different ways. They consume it in bite size. They live in a world of going down the pub. They live in a world of illegal streaming. They live in a world of FIFA, where they can get as involved in esport as they can in real sport. Football's got to be careful. It's got to be careful that it doesn't marginalise itself. Other sports that need exposure have had to take action. You know, rugby is a case in point where it's really important that the Six Nations is on terrestrial television doing fantastic audiences. They can still take the Sky dollar for the Autumn Internationals and so on. But it is absolutely vital, and you can see from the problems now in Premiership rugby, trying to monetize club rugby, that it just hasn't got the appeal, and therefore the grassroots of the game, which are vital to rugby because it isn't played in every school and every street in the land. Cricket's got to learn the lesson too, and is starting now to learn the lesson. Rugby league's almost sold its soul, really, in terms of changing its entire calendar just to get the television buck. Television is financing so many sports, and the tail is starting to wag the dog. And football's the really big dog, and at the moment television, even though it finances football, it doesn't have a big enough say, because football's in the hearts and minds of people in just about every nation in the world. But that can change if football's not careful. So I would love to be commentating on the same kind of calendar that ITV and BBC had 5/10 years ago. I tell you what I'd love to do. I'd love to commentate on a big Premier League game to a terrestrial audience, because that has never happened. Not a single Premier League game has ever been shown on terrestrial television. That's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, listen, Clive, you mentioned being in your mid-60s a couple of times. With the energy and your focus and attention to detail, you know, you definitely have many, many more years ahead of you, regardless of what the birth certificate might say. Thank you so much for your time, and enjoy the rest of your career.
Thank you.
Well, Clive Tilsey there, beginning about how he was just fascinated by television sport, which I guess has underpinned my career a bit. No doubt many of you out there who are listening and have the ambition to work in broadcasting, or maybe you're one of the people listening who already do and feel very similar. I loved his astute phrase about the advance of social media, particularly Twitter. Twitter is not an opinion poll. It's the loudest voices being heard. Really worth bearing that in mind, I think, sometimes for any of us who can be overly criticised for perhaps not the best reasons out there. Clive regularly lectures at universities about how he's forged such a successful career, and there were moments I think he fell a little bit into his lecturer's patter, but I'm so grateful to speak to one of those voices that just is football, that has been the voice of so many of those huge memories for football fans up and down the country and across the world, no doubt, as well. My huge thanks to him for taking the time to spend what was, well over an hour together in the end. And that is Series 1. Barry Davis, John Hunt, Nick Mullin, Sara Orchard, Bob Ballard and Clive Tildesley. As a podcast on commentary, I'd say that's a pretty decent spread. And there will be a series two. I've got commissioned by myself, and I'm recording the next one for series two in the next few days, in fact. So a huge thanks to all of my guests, to all of you for listening, getting in touch, leaving reviews. If you've enjoyed the chat with Clive, do go on, leave a few words of a review. I'll be really grateful. The next series is going to feature, with a bit of luck, because most of them have said yes, we're just trying to sort out times and meeting points, voices from athletics, boxing, cricket, football and rugby again, and a special live episode to come to at Podcast Live, as I mentioned in the introduction. Please get your tickets booked for that. It'll be a brilliant, unique event bringing the rugby podcast together. Q Commentator will be there too with a special rugby commentator chat. And as for the rest of Series 2, well, I'm hoping you won't have to wait too long, hopefully just 2 or 3 months' time to have a few more in the bag. They're busy people, these well-known and brilliant voices of sport. So have a lovely start to your summer. Keep in touch with us on @Q Commentator on Twitter with any suggested guests you'd like to hear from in future conversations. This has been a Rugby Media production. We'll see you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.